We discuss the work of an immigration legal services program in Madison on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. As of yesterday, the United Nations refugee data portal indicates more than 5.7 million people have fled Ukraine, neighboring Poland taking in a huge influx. Let's focus on Wisconsin and what immigration attorneys are encountering in the midst of a refugee crisis, and then Title 42 that has blocked migrants at our southern border from seeking asylum. Biden administration signaling Title 42 could be lifted later this month. Join in on immigration, 800-642-1234. Carmel Capati manages immigration legal services for the Catholic Multicultural Center in Madison. Carmel, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me here. Very excited to be here.
Well, let's start with Ukraine, the latest humanitarian crisis. And Homeland Security Department has a program to resettle 100,000 Ukrainians here in the U.S., which really is a tiny number when you consider just the huge influx of refugees. What immigration issues will Ukrainians face here?
So, just to sort of provide a little bit of background, so the program that's being set up for Ukrainians is somewhat similar to the program that had been set up or is in place for Afghans as well. And it is surrounding their ability to come to the United States through a humanitarian parole process. It is a relatively new implementation for Ukrainians, but if we are trying to compare a little bit to what we've been experiencing with the Afghan population and the humanitarian process, it's been a very slow process, I will say, for the Afghans, and I'm not sure if it's going to be that same slowness with Ukrainians as well.
Take us into humanitarian parole, if you could, and how it differs from other paths to refugee settlement or paths to citizenship.
Yep, that's it's a good question because it is a little bit confusing. The parole process or system, it's first of all, it's authority that's granted by the Department of Homeland Security. That would allow a person to come into the United States on a temporary basis. Mm-hmm. And usually that's for a humanitarian reason or a significant public benefit. And I say temporary, that's an important point to note because that's different than refugees who are coming into the U.S. who might have a ability to have more permanent process in place, meaning able to apply for a lawful permanent resident card. Parolees may have that opportunity, but they also may not. So it's a little bit different than the refugee process. For parolees who are coming into the United States, and again, I'm going to use the Afghan population just because we've been dealing mm-hmm. a lot with them since August. That since the Taliban took over, they do have the ability to get their employment authorization documents, meaning work lawfully, get their social security numbers. If they're being resettled by a resettlement agency, then they have the ability to get some assistance with housing and clothing mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. just getting settled in general. Right now in Wisconsin, I believe we have resettled approximately 850 Afghans through the resettlement process, meaning they were paroled in. Overall, I believe that across the country, about 76,000 were evacuated to the mm-hmm. United States. I think your listeners probably recall when there was about 13,000 that were housed at Fort McCoy.
Yes, yes. Yep.
And other bases while they were waiting to get processed. And of that, as I mentioned, that 13,000, about 850 have made their homes in Wisconsin.
talking with Carmel Kapati, who is the lead immigration attorney for the Catholic Multicultural Center in Madison, as we discuss her work, immigration issues globally, and take your questions, 800-642-1234. Carmel, looking more closely at the situation with Afghan refugees and the resettlement here, you mentioned about 850 Afghans going through that process here in Wisconsin to resettle. What have you seen through the lens of these Afghans going through this piece of the immigration process? What barriers have they encountered? What things have gone smoothly?
Great question. I would say from an immigration standpoint, so I guess what I'd want to say is that there are the families who are evacuated who are here, but then they have so many family members who are still abroad, who we are also working with or trying to find pathways for them to rejoin their families who are here. So that is one of our biggest barriers, are still trying to reunite families who were separated. Afghan families are pretty large in general. So we have families who are working with whose children, some children are still in Afghanistan. We are working with minors whose parents are still in Afghanistan. Mm. Some of the other challenges that they face are because of the speed at which some of them were evacuated, they don't have a lot of documentation, mm-hmm. Which is required to apply for an immigration benefit within our system. Lots of documents, lots of evidence, lots of mostly identity documents. And one of the challenges that we're facing is sometimes the identity documents don't necessarily match with other identity documents, meaning a birth certificate. They're called the national ID of Afghan is, it's called tazkiras. Sometimes that date of birth doesn't quite match their passport. The year might be wrong. And the reason why is because unlike here in the US, we're very record oriented and are very strict with dates. In Afghanistan, in order to get a birth certificate, you go to the proper authority and someone will look at you and say, you look like you're about maybe 12 years old. Wow. And then they would put that year on the card. So you may be 12, but you also might be 11 or you might be 10. So it's that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges for us is making sure that we have the proper documents to submit with their applications. And the other point I wanted to add is they're experiencing trauma. So of course they had to, those who are here had to evacuate in a horrible circumstance. And a lot of them, as I mentioned, are young people, are children. As I mentioned, one of my clients is a minor who was separated from his family when the bomb exploded at the airport. So they have, besides trying to navigate a whole new society, a whole new culture, they also miss their family.
I would imagine if the child is separated from a parent or a parent is still in the home country, that must be also traumatizing and so scary because you just don't know day to day what might happen.
Exactly. It is scary. And what I would sort of also want to share with the listeners is that just sort of going back to the humanitarian parole process. So people who are here in the U.S. who are evacuated were paroled in. But as I mentioned, there's also a process that can be applied to their family members who might still be abroad. And that could be in Afghanistan, but it can also be in Pakistan, or we've got families in Turkey who we're also working with who escaped Afghanistan. But there's the humanitarian process to bring those folks over to, which is very stalled, I would say. And it is very frustrating for us as advocates as to why it is taking so long to adjudicate some of these petitions for those families who are still abroad.
We're discussing immigration issues in The View from Wisconsin with Carmel Carpati, who leads immigration legal services for the Madison-based Multicultural Catholic Center. You can join in at any point here, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment with Carmel Carpati here on the Ideas Network. We're hearing a viewpoint on our immigration system here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So as a backdrop, thousands of people took to the streets in Milwaukee earlier this week demanding that President Biden pass protections for immigrant workers. The statewide immigrant and worker rights group, Voces de la Frontera Action, they organized a two-day general strike for immigrant rights and a rally at the state capitol. Join in on immigration issues. Your questions, 800-642-1234. We have immigration attorney Carmel Carpati, who's with us for about nine more minutes. Carmel, let's change focus here to your center. The Catholic Multicultural Center helps people from as many as 60 countries. I'm wondering what type of immigration cases take up the bulk of your time. Where is your energy directed in immigration law?
So, yes, we serve a huge a variety of folks from different countries. I would say Catholic Multicultural Center is one of the only agencies that does provide so many different kinds of services in the family-based immigration arena, as well as the humanitarian-based arena. What takes up most of, I would say comprises most of our cases would be DACA renewals. Hmm. However, we also do a lot of citizenship applications, as well as family-based petitions where certain family members are trying to petition for a spouse or a parent or a child. U visas, which are visas available to individuals who are victims of qualifying crimes. We do have some asylum cases that we're also working on. So, gosh, really, we almost take anything that comes within the family-based or humanitarian-based arena, as long as the individuals don't make enough money. So because we are a nonprofit agency, we primarily serve no income or low income folks. And they also have to be within our 11 county service area, mm-hmm. which is primarily South Central Wisconsin. So we are super busy, but we're just so happy that to be here because there's a great need, a huge need for services.
Let's turn now to the U.S.-Mexico border. Talk Title 42, in particular, the public health order that gives border officials the power to block asylum seekers and migrants from reaching the U.S. at ports of entry, expel them to Mexico or their home countries rather than going through the processing of immigration laws. And the CDC said Title 42 could end later this month. What are your thoughts on the order and the potential for it to be lifted?
So I know it is a controversial policy that was in place, and just so folks understand, when we're talking about Title 42 of the U.S. Code, Section 265, and it had been used to stop the entry of people in the U.S. based upon the COVID pandemic or for public health concerns, and what it allowed is the prohibition of primarily single adults and families to be turned away at the border if they presented a danger regarding a communicable disease. It was started in March 20 of 2020, and you're right, hundreds of thousands were denied entry into the U.S. My understanding is that it will be lifted maybe around May 23rd was what I saw the latest news. What we're going to see, what I suspect, is even more levels of migration coming in to the border, but also making their way to Wisconsin. And I don't have a particular opinion on it other than we want to be prepared to be able to serve the families, the eligible families who come to us with legal claims, and we want to be able to serve them competently and adequately. So if it gets lifted, we will be ready for the work that will come based upon that lifting of the order.
I wonder if it's been a tool to control migration rather than purely a tool for public health to fight COVID.
Mm-hmm. That's, I think, a very common assessment, and I believe there is some truth to that. I think what I think is difficult and challenging as an immigration advocate, as an immigration lawyer, is the fact that the way that immigration laws change so quickly. Mm. And for us advocates, we are just trying to keep up to date with the changes, the rapid changes in policies based upon political whims and who's making the decision depending upon, you know, which side you're on. What we're focused on is our people, our immigrants, our clients who deserve these services. And we want to make sure that we're providing competent services and are up to date on what the new laws are. So yeah, sometimes it gets overwhelming if we think about too much sort of the rationale behind the changes, because we're just so focused on getting the work done and working with our vulnerable populations, because that's what we care about.
What have you seen by way of a backlog? At the end of last year, the number of incomplete immigration cases in our U.S. courts was almost at 1.6 million. Is that affecting your clients?
It is affecting our clients. And one of the big things that this backlog has been causing is just simply a backlog in employment authorization documents, or their work permits, as they're known. So again, that is so important for a lot of our clients, just the ability to work here lawfully while they're waiting for their case to be adjudicated, while they might be waiting for their immigration court hearing trial to be held. What they really just want to do is to be able to work here lawfully. And that's, I think, one of the most tangible, negative things of this backlog is their ability to be able to work. There's so many downsides to the backlog. But again, if you're, if you have an asylum case and your trial isn't set for, you know, another 2 years or 3 years,
what are you going to do in the meantime?
Exactly. But also from a legal standpoint, you've got to work with facts that of things that occurred 5 years ago, and you have to bring them to life in your trial, your asylum trial, you know, like 5 years later. And sometimes that's difficult to keep preparing and mm-hmm. re-preparing. And if a hearing gets set over again, you have to prepare all over again.
Many redos.
Oh my goodness. This is why it's just such a headache working through our immigration system, which is so complicated.
I want to land here on language. We only have less than a minute left, but you previously supervised translators for the Wisconsin court system. And mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, how does that experience inform how you communicate in your center and what you see in the area of communicating in native languages?
Thank you for asking that great question. Yes, we use interpreters for individuals whenever they request it. And we think it's very important to do because, as you know, as your listeners know, people communicate better in their first language. And we want to make sure that they're comfortable sharing as many details as they can in a way that they are able to do so. So yes, we use often community interpreters. We use interpreters through agencies. Sometimes a family member might be able to communicate or be able to interpret okay. So mm-hmm. sometimes we'll do that too. Mostly we don't have a big budget for our interpreter services, but we use interpreters very regularly.
Carmel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Carmel Kapati manages immigration legal services for the Catholic Multicultural Center in Madison. Ahead this hour, we get reaction to the leaked draft opinion that appears to show the Supreme Court poised to overturn Roe. Join in with your reaction, your questions for a former state Supreme Court justice. 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. That's the sound Tuesday at the state capitol as hundreds of demonstrators gathered on the news of the High Court's draft opinion to overturn Roe. Given that you've had some space, some time to reflect on these SCOTUS developments, what are you seeing around the country? What would you like to bring up? 800-642-1234 to join in. Janine Geske is a distinguished professor of law at Marquette University Law School, former director of the Marquette Law School's Restorative Justice Initiative, was a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court and a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. Judge Geske, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Before we get to the ramifications of a possible overturn of Roe, let's start with the leaked draft opinion. And your thoughts on the High Court secrecy that's been breached here in a really unprecedented way. We don't know how Politico got a hold of the draft. We do know that it's authentic. What are your thoughts on the leak?
I'm really sad about that. I mean, it really has been a sacred confidentiality around the Supreme Court. And knowing from having been on our own Supreme Court, there are a lot of rewrites and drafting and changing of votes. And to have this released early on, you know, it gives a sense that everybody knows what the decision's going to be. And it may turn out to be what we've seen, but it may be very different. And I think it's really, really unfortunate this happened. You know, and I also don't understand why anybody would release it, because I don't think it favors anybody to have it out there before there's, you know, in final form. So, you know, maybe it was hacked. I don't know how it got out.
Would a first draft of a majority opinion penned by Justice Alito, circulated in February, remain the majority opinion of the court months later? Do majorities, I think I'm asking, hold historically, or might they fall apart?
It could be either. And the thing is, we don't know if there's a leader. We don't know if that was the first draft and whether somebody else has penned another draft. You know, it's not unusual for people to change their votes or modify their votes. And I mean, it could easily be that Chief Justice Roberts said to Justice Alito, all right, you want to reverse Roe, write an opinion that says that, then let's circulate it and let's talk about other possibilities. I've been on the court where people have changed their vote a week before the final opinion comes out and had to flip the whole decision. So those things can happen. And, it may very well be the opinion, but I think it's going to be very different, even if it does reverse Roe, than what we're seeing now. Things get modified frequently in the rewrites.
I think it's hard from high court onlookers, people who are very much outside the legal system, to understand even what are the protocols around a draft opinion. What does it even mean? And I'm wondering if you can kind of take us inside the court to explain how a draft opinion comes together, where it goes, what that process is like.
Sure. Well, what happens is the court obviously heard arguments, and then there is what we call a tentative vote. So people tentatively say, well, you know, I think the Mississippi law ought to be upheld, or I think Roe ought to be reversed, or I think we should just leave Roe v. Wade alone. And so they take votes, and Then Chief Justice Roberts at the court assigns the opinion to somebody who he believes is in the current majority to write it. So obviously Justice Alito was assigned to write it. He then goes back with his clerk and works for some time at trying to write a majority opinion. And so that's what we see. That is the opinion of Justice Alito. Then what happens is it gets circulated to all the other chambers, all the other justices, and their law clerks and the justices look at it, and they give him comments about, you know, I don't like this paragraph. I think this goes too far. I can't agree with you on this. This is good. And what happens is they go into rewrite mode, and so Justice Alito would start maybe modify his opinion, or if not, there may be another concurring opinion that agrees with the result but for different reasons, and then whoever is in dissent would write the dissent, and there still can be modifications down the road. So it is very common that there are multiple rewrites before the public sees the case when it's released. And I suspect this case won't be one which is released before the end of June or well into July.
Wait, say that again. When do you expect it?
The end of June or the middle of July. The court shuts down, but it takes a while to get those opinions out. So at the latest, it'll be out in July.
What kind of damage does this leaked document do to the court's reputation, its integrity, even its ability to function with the justices among themselves?
Well, it does a lot of damage. I think that people have at least trusted the process within the Supreme Court. People may, you know, not be happy with particular justices, but we know that they're deliberating and changing things. And now that there's somebody who has access to a draft of an opinion and releases it, it's going to change how justices feel about circulating drafts, particularly if they can't find who did it. I don't understand how this benefits anybody to have it out, because obviously we have protests going on and people taking positions on this opinion, and I suspect the opinion we see will be written differently than the one we're reading now.
You mentioned one word earlier, a possible hack. Are you concerned about the security of operations within the Supreme Court?
Well, I am. I am, because people have not talked about that possibility, but it seems to me that, you know, with cybersecurity and issues of security, hacking into institutions, websites and systems is not uncommon. And, you know, we don't know where Politico got the article. The other part I think is sad is people are guessing that it was this justice or that justice with no, from at least from my viewpoint, no facts to support it. So it's attacking the integrity of particular justices and or law clerks. And it could well be someone from outside who was able to obtain a copy.
Sounds like you feel this could damage the court's reputation, and it's really its ability to function, and how it has moved through these historical processes is kind of been upended.
Yeah, it'll be hard to trust. Well, and I think it will affect the writing of drafts inside, particularly if they can't find out who leaked it. A justice may not be as free to write what he or she thinks, you know, the opinion should say, if they have to worry that somehow it's going to be released to the public before other justices have had an opportunity to comment and maybe modify it. So I think it's a really serious breach and very unfortunate. I mean, I hope that the Chief Justice is able to figure out, you know, how it got out. But I think it does impact the ability for them to do the work as they have in the past.
Talking with Jeanine Geske, who's a former justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court and a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. She's also a distinguished professor of law at Marquette University Law School. As we talk about the leak, the Roe versus Wade, looking more at what is happening in our judicial branch, the High Court, 800-642-1234 to join in. Let's turn to Roe now. And I want to get what your initial thoughts were back in 1973 when the Supreme Court ruled on Roe v. Wade, marking abortion legal. Where were you and what did you feel in those moments?
Well, I was actually in law school in 1973, mm-hmm. so it certainly was a subject of discussion at the time. You know, I can't say I was following the case before it came out. I remember thinking, you know, that it was far-reaching. It was a very strong statement in support of abortions in the United States. It changed the law that existed in many states. And I suspected there was going to be turmoil over the decision. And here we are today still having turmoil over, you know, the Supreme Court decision. So it was, you know, there were abortions being given during that time. There were people traveling to get those abortions. And it really sort of freed up, you know, each individual state to be able to open up abortion clinics if it chose to and not worry about criminal prosecutions.
Interesting. Now, the swing there, now this could free up states to close clinics to make it illegal. And the draft reads that Roe and Casey must be overruled and the authority to regulate abortion must be returned to the people and their elected representatives. Casey, that 1992 ruling affirming. So if the draft becomes the law of the land, state legislatures would be free to restrict all abortion in almost all circumstances. Is that right from this draft?
That is right. And in fact, it probably in Wisconsin will restrict all abortions. There's some debate, and we can talk about it, about the applicability of a law from 1849, but it allows states to make those decisions. And it's been interesting because legislators around the country have not had to debate this issue. You know, because it became the law of the land that they were lawful, legislatures didn't have to take positions. I mean, they could talk about their position on abortion, but they did not have to vote and didn't have to you know, create laws, and now they're going to be in the middle of it, you know, in each individual state and going to be hearing from the different constituencies what they want their particular state to do with this.
Let's take a call now. Jesse joining us from WASA. Jesse, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm just curious, isn't it possible that it's a good thing that the public could be aware of a decision that's being discussed on the Supreme Court? At the end of the day, an informed public that protests is still informing one of our democratic bodies to make a decision on our behalf.
Jesse, thank you. Jesse arguing that this leaked opinion is a good thing.
Well, I think the problem with it is many people are going to believe that that's the final opinion, the majority opinion, and it may be, but I think, you know, if it comes out differently, then people are going to hypothesize that the court changed its opinion because of pressures from outside, and that's not a good thing. The justices are very knowledgeable about what's going on in the real world. They know about the polls, the national polls, in terms of people who are in favor of having liberal abortion laws versus those who feel very strongly about the restriction of abortions. They're aware of those things. And so it really goes to the heart of the opinion. People are going to hypothesize if this decision is different, that they caved to some kind of pressure from outside, and that is not good for the court.
Former State Supreme Court Justice, Law Professor Jeanine Geske, our guide, presenting her thoughts on the U.S. Supreme Court's intention to overturn Roe, what might happen in the next couple months in advance of a decision coming out. Still time for you on the leak, our nation's reactions, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Jeanine Geske here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're getting reaction to the Roe v. Wade developments. What happens in Wisconsin if the High Court overturns Roe in light of the leaked draft memo that surfaced in recent days from Politico? Marquette Law School professor, former State Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske stays with us. Let's go to Matt now in Milwaukee. Matt, hi. What's coming up for you?
Hi. My question is, well, first of all, I'm glad it was leaked out. And what I'm getting the impression is that the ruling, if it stood the way it is, would say that we don't have the right to privacy, but the Supreme Court does. And I'm imagining, you know, what the world would look like if a patient and their doctor don't have the right to privacy. Does that mean that we will, you know, have police officers in an exam room or any other invasions of our personal conversations with our doctors?
Matt, thank you. Matt, worried about the domino effect here on the right to privacy. Jeanine Geske.
Well, I think it's a really interesting question, comparing the right to privacy of the court versus individuals. And obviously, the court isn't recognizing that it has a constitutional right to privacy, but trying to keep its deliberations private until it gets issued. In terms of enforceability, I think what will happen is that in Wisconsin or other places where abortion is probably outlawed or outlawed, is that clinics and other facilities that are currently providing abortion will shut down. And I think Planned Parenthood in Wisconsin has already indicated that once it's clear that it's illegal in Wisconsin, they will not be providing abortions. I know that other states where it's still legal are, you know, getting ready for people to travel in. And so I think it's not so much the discussion between the lawyer and, I mean, the client, the patient and the doctor, but it will be the availability for women who are interested in getting an abortion and where they can go. And he is correct in that the court is finding that there is not a, you know, that abortion is not, does not fall under the right of privacy that has been recognized by the court in certain specific cases.
So if I understand right, the 1849 state law doesn't penalize the person who's pregnant, but establishes a felony charge for providers performing the abortions. And that is where the concern you see.
Yeah, that's true. So it was a six-year felony for, I think, in the first 15 weeks, and I think it was a larger felony after that. I believe in 1950, Wisconsin enacted a law to make it criminal for a woman to have an abortion. And one of the complicating factors, if this decision mirrors the opinion that's been leaked, is what's going to happen in terms of prosecutions. The Attorney General has indicated that he thinks there's some defenses to trying to enforce an 1849 law. I can go through those if you want, but that he believes it may not be enforceable. Whether it is or not, he's indicated he will not be bringing prosecutions. But, of course, anyone in the 72 counties, any prosecutor in the 72 counties, could bring those prosecutions. And if all the clinics are closed in Wisconsin, it's not going to be very common that, or even maybe impossible to get an abortion in a place that's safe and medical, and it may just be backdoor abortions.
Talking with Jeanine Geske, former justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, also distinguished professor of law at Marquette University Law School. Let's take another call now. Jeremiah in Sheboygan. Hi, Jeremiah.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
So I guess, like, I'm really happy that the leak came out, and I've got 9 tiny violins for the justices if it makes their judicial lives a little bit more difficult. In the future, the Supreme Court is one of, if not the most important branch of the government with regards to how people interact with the law. And it is also the least transparent. No TVs allowed in the courtroom. And then a bunch of old people go into a room and talk and issue rulings. And I think it would be nice to see some more transparency with regards to rough drafts of decisions, because I think in the future, it will give us some historical context for some of these landmark decisions that wasn't available. I mean, imagine if we had some better historical context in Dred Scott or Brown, we would be able to have a richer understanding of the laws and the decisions. And I think with the lack of transparency right now, all it is some old people in a room coming out to deny people's rights.
So Jeremiah, I'm hearing that really wants this to be a path to more sunlight. Jeanine Geske.
I have a couple of comments. First, I happen to agree with him, Jeremiah, in terms of cameras in the courtroom. And as a trial court judge in Wisconsin, way back in 1981, we had cameras in our courtrooms at all times. So I agree that I think the federal courts are antiquated by not having cameras. You know, what the thing about the courts is that we hope under our constitutional system that they are independent, not subject to influence, and are really examining the law. There is a lot of historical perspective in those opinions. They're very long, sometimes too long, and they explain, you know, historically why a particular justice or justices come to a conclusion. And certainly you can listen to the arguments that is available online, to listen to the arguments the parties have made, or even, you know, go to a law library and take a look at the briefing. But it's supposed to be an argument on the law and not on popular opinion or undue influence from other sources. So it's not the justices that I'm worried about, but it's the integrity and the independence of that third branch of government. And that's been taking a hit for lots of reasons in the last 20 years in terms of political influence and outside forces. And I think that as much as we can to preserve that independence, we need to do that because that's what makes our democracy work.
We only have less than a minute left, but I want to end on politics. You know, say the Democrats carve out an exception for the filibuster to codify abortion rights, then Republicans later carve out to ban abortion. Could we end up going back and forth over this issue perhaps every election cycle?
Well, if the opinion looks like the draft, the answer is yes. We could be returning to it often. And I hope that's not the case. You know, one of the things that's really important is stability in the law and precedents. And, you know, Justice Alito tried to explain why he was throwing out precedents and not respecting stare decisis, whether you accept it or not is, you know, a matter of your reading. But I think going back and forth on this issue would be damaging to people in this country and an understanding of when is a constitutional right and when it isn't.
Judge Geske, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Jeanine Geske, former justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court and a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. She's also a distinguished professor of law at Marquette University Law School. Just ahead, we're going to go birding with a naturalist from Thousand Islands Environmental Center, a conservancy of more than 350 acres in Kakana. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.